hard for us to eat or anything?
And we're opening the show with that.
Delicious.
You said there was a surprise. I hope it's a pig heart.
And hello, everyone. This is Cameron Marceau with Black Liver Project doing another episode of Monster in a Glass, where we are taking a cocktail and we explore the origins and the name and who made it and why, and then dive into a little bit of history from the time period. And we're doing a little bit of history through cocktails, not just the history of the cocktail, because sometimes there just isn't a whole lot.
That's true. That is true.
And so we like to embellish, spice it up, have a little more fun.
With relish?
And that word does make me think of, yeah.
It totally does. It's like the same word.
Could you not ever think of relish with any Elish word?
Elish is a weird end. So.
I know.
Elish relish.
That's your $1 million fucking idea right there. Elish super relish. Hot.
Oh, I'm sure.
Burny
so
relish.
Elish relish. Try this hot dog, motherfucker. Yeah.
Put this in your mouth.
And with that, we're gonna do have a heart.
Have a heart.
Put that heart in your mouth. Thunk dunk. Did we already say it's have a heart?
I don't know if we did.
I don't know.
So, yeah, the next cocktail we're going to explore is called the have a heart cocktail. That's a hell of a long name and kind of.
It sounds like it's like a line from a movie. That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, it's like from like. You know,
yeah, Casablanca,
Leave It to Beaver kind of era. You know, yeah. Like
have a heart, Beaver.
Ask Michael at the Brixton if he can make you a Leave It to Beaver cocktail. Just be like, no, I don't know what's in it. Just use your imagination. Whatever screams, Leave It to Beaver.
So, have a heart. I'm joined here by my good friend Jason Cruz.
Hello.
We're also here with Professor Mick Bone Doctor Layman.
Professor.
We should have sound effects. Like that. Oh, that was a good one.
So, what's the story here? What's in it?
So what's in it is, and I'm not even sure how this would taste. I keep looking at the ingredients and I'm like, I can't get a good sense of how this might taste. But it's Swedish punch, gin, grenadine syrup, half a lime, and then top with pineapple and cherry.
Ooh, it's sweet. What the hell is Swedish punch?
You have not had the Swedish punch.
I thought we did the sweet. Oh no, that was something else. Oof. There was one that you called
Swedish punch. Swedish punch is like
Secret of the Vikings?
It's like proto rum.
Oh.
It's a sugar based.
Oh, buried in the ground. It's not that. Oh, that's kind of 20.
No, see, I feel like we might have had this before. It
does smell like rum, though. It's
yeah, it does. It's very sweet smelling.
Yep.
I know I've at least had it before, but I want to try it again.
I didn't realize that was like an ingredient. Swedish punch. Two parts lutefisk. Oh, it smells interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Let's
it smells good.
Put it in your car.
It's like Vikings.
Skål. Wow. That is absolutely not what I thought it was going to be.
It's like a kind of nameless sweetness.
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't even know how to
it has like a weird kerosene aftertaste.
That's
yeah, it fucking tastes like sugar with kerosene in it. That's brilliant. Thank you, sweets.
We knew it.
I want
sweet
more of
kerosene.
This.
Sweet fuel.
God, that's good.
How do you keep going in the winter cold of Sweden?
Drinks
kerosene and sugar.
Kerosene.
I kind of like it.
Yeah, it's the fire that you need. My parents just recently did the DNA info thing. And we're all like, oh yeah, we're Irish, we're this, we're that. No, we're all from Sweden. Like, that's like my blood is from like Viking land.
Wow,
yeah,
so this is crazy.
Yeah, they just recently... No, not at all. Like, well, my mom knew that she, like, a part of their heritage was, like, Norwegian or like, a sliver. But not, like, all of us.
Like, well, let's be honest, like, most of Europe is
everybody
is
was dominated by Viking blood, yeah. But it's pretty funny. The only problem with that is the Mormons will convert your soul to eternity to the whole Mormon thing. The most of the DNA tree, they did Ancestry.com. It is Mormon-based, and this is not, I'm not making this up, that they go back and the those of who have passed, they commit them, they have ceremonies to the Mormon faith to indoctrinate them into being Mormons.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's a thing. Now, there's a really good special on Mormonism on PBS. It's like a 4 or 5 or 6 hour thing about what they do. Yeah,
4 or 5 or 6 hours.
It's pretty long.
Of what the Mormons do.
Yeah, it's pretty
that's
long.
How they convert people.
Yeah, it's pretty long.
Sit here and watch this.
I don't know. Long. It's like 4 or 5 or 7.
When you get
hours.
To hour 3 and a half, you're like okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Hand me my magic underwear. Yeah. I'm on board.
Yeah.
I don't.
I'm signing up. Check it out.
Huh.
Mm-hmm. Anyways, music news.
That's it. I like that flavor. I feel like I would. It's almost like a wine in a way.
It is
or
wine.
More like a port,
but without the grape, without the fruit.
Yeah, it's not as rich.
Yeah,
as, I agree. But
like,
it's sweet.
Like all
it's
of
sweet.
The sweet from the port, but none of the fruit.
Like they found somehow found a good like what? An in between between wine and rum.
Do you know like how or
wum.
Wum.
Dude, let's do it. This is what we're. This is our. The craft spirit movement will create one.
The craft spirit
wum.
Animal?
Animal. Wum. Come to Wum.
Your
first and last stop.
We could be all hipster about it, too. Yeah. We could be like, you've never had Wum before?
Wow.
Or what?
What
yeah,
is
like,
wrong with you?
Put down your glass of Malort. We're going to have some.
Everything turns into W's.
What is Wum with you? You mean Wum.
Okay.
So, the Have a Hard Cocktail, this one was sort of easy and also kind of frustrating because it really only shows up in one book. And what book is that? PGD.
As in definitive.
What book did he write? What was it called?
His book was called The Official Mixer's Manual from 1934. And,
you gotta get like a... Mixer's Manual. Mixer. PGD.
I'll leave it up to you to
okay. Orchestrate it. Big old
do we ever say
drop.
His name anymore?
Yeah, we don't even.
It's just, it's too long. It's PGD just is easier to say. Plus, we've all got tattoos of PGD now, so we...
It's done. It has been written.
But that was the easy part. They, you know, I was like, oh, you know, have a heart. It's unique. It's not, you know, something where you're going to be like, oh, it's a one... word thing that I have to try to figure out if it's like we're getting irrelevant hits in books, but so it was easy to search, but I searched through like 50 books and I couldn't find it anywhere except his manual. So I'm gonna say it's not popular. It probably never took off. What is weird about it is that it is in quotation marks. That was kind of what, you know, we had talked about. It's like, why is it in quotation marks? I mean, it must be a proper name then. It must be a title of something or mean something.
It feels like a line.
That's what I, you know, it was something. I mean, yeah. I don't know why you
more
would
than it more than it is. Like it feels right. More than it is.
So Haig claims that it was named after a movie from 1934 by the name of Have a Heart. So I was like, okay, well let's explore this angle.
Yeah.
And the plot that I saw on the Turner Classic Movie site was, a street vendor tries to help a dancing teacher who's lost the use of her legs. So basically, I was like,
oh, that old thing.
Oh, jeez, of course.
That archetype.
Yes. It's so light.
It makes
airy.
Sense.
We've
a dance teacher.
Paraplegic.
We've seen it over and over. I mean, isn't there a Bible story?
That's horrible.
A dance teacher, Swedish punch, it makes perfect sense. So I was like, so basically the story
Shakespeare
is...
Shakespeare did it originally.
Right?
This is just a rip-off.
Yeah, it totally is.
So basically, this dance teacher falls off a balcony. She busts up her knee. But so you think, like, somebody falls off a balcony, or, like, they're, like, way hurt. But it's like, no, she just kind of busted up her knee. And she has to wear a big...
Not in the 1930s.
First floor balcony,
They didn't have serious balconies in the 30s.
Nah. But she had to wear a big boot, and then, you know, there's some Viennese doctor. But because she's a dance instructor, my knee hurts, so I can't be a dance instructor. So there's a Viennese doctor, and he says, I can fix your knee for $500.
Which is like everything.
Yeah,
back then.
$3,000, easy.
So she's trying to figure out how to get this $500. She goes on a date. There's some dog involved. Hijinks ensue, and she gets her knee fixed and finds love. So
she has to eat a pig heart.
I'm summarizing. She eats a pig heart. That was at the very end.
At the end,
when she finds love. But
this is like a rom com.
It is absolutely a rom. I'm summarizing.
I'm 30s rom-com. Expecting like where's Will Smith? You know, it's like
who's the king? The English guy, the rom com king.
Oh, Hugh Grant.
Hugh Grant.
Yeah.
This is a Hugh Grant thing.
It almost sounded like that, and it, like, this is, I boiled that down to two sentences, but it was, they had a whole big ass paragraph, and I was like, this story doesn't make any sense, like, none of this makes sense. But when you said, oh, it sounds like a rom-com, it's like, oh yeah, okay, now that makes more sense. It was like, there was just a lot of things. So it was like, there was a dog, like, I'm talking about this dog. I was like, what does the dog have to do with...
Right.
It was like, oh, then she gets her knee fixed. And isn't it funny? She falls in love with the same guy who did whatever. But there's, like, other things, like hijinks. Let's just say hijinks.
Yeah, a little bit of hanky-panky.
Right, a little bit of hanky-panky. So, I didn't see the connection ever. I was like, all right, whatever. Yeah, sure, okay. It's named after the movie. But I started digging around because I thought, well, quotation marks, it must be something. And it turns out there was also a play called Have a Heart from 1917.
Wait a minute, 1934?
1934. Keep that in mind. It was 1934 that this movie came out. And when was the book that PGD published? 1934. So, we'll come back to that.
Okay.
But this play, 1917, and the plot of this is, it is the final reconciliation of department store proprietor from his wife, from whom he is about to be parted by divorce. I did not write that line, by the way, if you couldn't tell.
Wow, for whom?
Basically, there's a movie queen, a pretty shop girl, hijinks ensue, lots of humorous misunderstandings.
Sounds like Oscar Wilde. That's the kind of crap he did.
So I was like, well, let's look into this. I mean, it's before he writes the book. You know, it shows up on Broadway. He was in New York. So yeah, it was off Broadway, but it was in New York. So it opened up at the Liberty Theater on January 11th, 1917. And it only ran, and then they said only ran for 76 performances. I was like, that's kind of, seems like a lot, right? Wow. But maybe at the time there was a lot, you know, maybe they were running for a lot.
Wait, 76? How do Broadway performances run? Do they run every night?
And generally,
they might.
You'd have like at least one a day and then maybe a matinee. So like there might be a double up on at some point. But so 76 is...
So like 8 a week?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess 76 does seem low. I mean, when I saw it, I was like, only?
How long do most Broadway shows last?
I mean, they'll hit for a while.
Yeah.
Like, Hamilton's been rocking it for a year. Yeah, a year or two.
So 76 is
probably
crap.
Shitty, yeah. I mean, I guess,
it seems moderate.
I know,
like a week would be bad.
And I don't know what it was like in 1970.
It ran for two shows.
and then we just lit the whole set on fire and said, fuck it.
That show was awful.
This play sucks. Just kill it. Yeah, no, I mean, I was trying to put it, I kept seeing 76. I was like, that seems like an awful lot. But like, if you put it in perspective of the time too, there wasn't TV.
Yeah,
there was barely movies, so this was what you went to. 76 was probably like, oh, you poor theater actors. Like, you didn't even get a chance. Yeah. Like, but they said it faced stiff competition during the 1916-1917 theater season when 25 musicals opened up on Broadway. So maybe that explains, like, the 76, others were running for a lot longer. And then they say the short run... was also caused because the star performer Billy B. Van was hired away by a competing producer.
Okay.
So it was cut short, but I started looking into reviews. It was not a good play, apparently.
And that's why the star was like...
I didn't look too much into him, but he was also... It sounds like he was kind of hot shit. Like, he was the next big thing, and people were trying just to get waiting, a hold of him. Yeah. So... he was not
going to stick with it. It was an audition for him.
Right. A review said, it was another Broadway disappointment. So, it sounds like it wasn't that good. And I started thinking, well, why would he name it after this, then? Like, if it was a short-run play that nobody really thought was good. The interesting thing about it was that it was co-written by P.G. Woodhouse, who I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with him, but he's actually really famous. He wrote a series of books called Cheese and Worcester, which actually became a BBC series called that had Hugh Laurie and Stephen Fry. So P.G. Woodhouse, so he wrote the play, or co-wrote the play. And so at the time, I mean, you're thinking like, oh, it must be... But
was this one of his first, though?
No, I think he was already writing at the time, but based on the description of what the play was about, and knowing what I know about his books, is like, yep, that sounds about right. It's similar kind of content. There's weird misunderstandings and hijinks and something saves the day, and it's really, it seemed appropriate, it seemed right, but apparently it didn't do that well. So I looked at these two things and I thought, I actually can't imagine that these are named after the musical or the movie. I looked at the ingredients, I thought, like, is there something there?
It's gotta be just the guy who made it.
Yeah.
If it's Patrick Evan Duffy who made it, then you have to look and see why he would name it after.
Yeah.
I feel like that's the only way, because he's the artist, the architect of the drink, and so he gets to name it, and so why is he naming it after shows?
And that's sort of where I went, because I thought, well, I'm not seeing a connection. I think the movie's kind of bullshit. I think that's a different, you know, not really a good connection. But, you know, we talked about this, and I thought, okay, you know, I'm going to go and I'm going to look. I'm going to see, maybe there is a connection. Maybe it was PGD. Maybe it was just something. Maybe he loved this play. Maybe it was his favorite play.
Right.
It spoke to him.
Yeah, yeah. Something about it. He
went to all 76 shows.
He was...
Maybe the lead actor was his father.
Or his lover. Or his lover, brother. Yeah. Or his cousin. Right. You know, something. Where you're like, well, why would he, you know, like, why would he name that? So I went back to his book. And
have a heart, Daddy. Have a heart.
It's beautiful. I went back to this book and I just started looking through it, and I had forgotten that in the preface to his book, and saw this information. So he writes the book in 1934, he helped write the book, because it was actually the work of a publisher, you know, dragged him into this. But in the preface, he talks about the bartender days, his bartender days, and he
pre-prohibition
he served a lot of famous people like Cecil B. DeMille, Oscar Wilde, J.P. Morgan Sr., and famous actors like Edwin Booth, who, by the way, is John Wilkes Booth's brother. He was a very famous actor, theater actor at the time. Frank Bunce, who was a business manager of the Lyceum Theater in New York. E.H. Sothern, who was another actor. I started seeing a pattern here.
So he was hanging out with
the dudes.
He was in New York. He wasn't necessarily... He worked at the Ashland House. He wasn't necessarily that close to Broadway, but you gotta imagine there's other theaters. And
yeah, maybe he's close to shitty plays.
I love shitty plays. Yeah. So then
you're gonna need some booze because you're canceled again.
But,
you know, I love the off.
Yeah.
Off.
Broadway. Off all.
I like it shitty and I like it real. It's anything, you know, give it to me raw.
Yep.
As I read that, I went, oh, yes, we talked about this in a previous drink. So, sort of his, about Patrick Gavin Duffy a little bit. And it reminded me that there was a newspaper article that he wrote disputing who the first person to make the highball was. And in that article, he says, in 1894, I opened a little cafe next to the old Lyceum. So again, makes sense that he was this Frank Bunce character. There were a lot of prominent actors, writers, and men about town, in quotation marks. I don't know. This is the phrasing. I had to keep reading this because I was like, what is he saying? who were not occasional patrons of my place between acts. So like, who were so not? Were. So it was like, yeah. I was like, so what you're saying is they were there all the time.
Yeah.
So it was in the spring of 1894 that Mr. Ratcliffe joined the stock company, which, under the management of Daniel Frohman, including Messrs. Kelsey, Lemoyne, I went through these names, but basically what he's getting at is Mr. Ratcliffe was an actor. He came up with the name of Highball, and he came up with the drink. So it was just lending sort of credence that he was hanging around a lot of actors, theater actors at the time. So I said, okay, well, so this is starting to make the story a little bit more plausible. It's pushing away from the movie and more toward the musical. And he has a lot of recipes, but there are drinks named after theater actors and film actors. There's one called the Harry Lauder, who was a Scottish singer and a vaudeville comedian. The Mikado, which he didn't invent. The Mikado drink came from another book. The Mary Pickford also came from another book. But they're in there.
This seems to be the pulse point.
I wouldn't say that there were that many, though. I went through the whole list, and I was, and maybe there were others in there that I just don't recognize, because it's from 1934, and if there were theater actors, I might... There were other people with, like, named ones, that, you know, and I'm like, who the fuck is that guy?
But
I don't
this
know.
Is PGD, right?
This is PGD!
Right? So, like, I mean, is he, like, in the theater district? That's his...
It didn't seem... He worked at the Ashland Theater, which was at 24th and 4th. And 4th is Park Avenue.
But if he's serving these folks, like, what a creative...
He clearly was... It was a place where he worked where theater people hung out.
Okay.
So he knew famous people. He was serving famous people. Yeah.
Okay.
One of the ideas...
You know what I'm saying? Like, it's kind of an osmosis thing. Like, yeah. He's around these folks.
Uh-huh. Right. I mean, you probably just by... You know, if you have an actor who's coming up with a name for the highball...
Right.
You know, you probably have a lot of people coming up with weird names
for everything.
And they're creative like, never drink after me!
Those goddamn creative types.
Right. So, on your suggestion, Cam, that you said, well, you know, maybe look for drinks with quotation marks. Like, maybe there's others. Maybe this is his thing. So, I started looking around, and there's a few, not many, but the ones that were. So, we have The Hoopla, which was... a film from 1933 starring Claire Beau. Now, it's not clear if it's named after me. I will say PGD does not give any indication of where the drinks come from. There's nothing. It's just a recipe.
So that was a film?
That was a film.
Was it originally a theater?
I'm not sure. I didn't look at that. Okay. All I found was that it was a film. Hootsman. There was a film starring Stan Laurel in 1919 called Hootman. I don't know if that's related. Possibly. Then there was other ones that were in quotation marks, like the LG, Old Pal, SG, and the Everybody Irish. And that was about it. So there weren't many. It wasn't a thing. It wasn't like a thing that he did.
But probably more than most cocktail books, right?
I can't say for sure. Possibly. Okay. But the last one, the Everybody Irish, I looked at it and I thought, well, is this a movie or a film? And it turns out it was just full of green stuff and whiskey. Honestly, it had
just like St. Patrick's Day.
Seriously,
just like the Irish.
Yeah,
they love green.
Full of mint, olives, and whiskey. Seriously, it had mint and olives in it. I was like, that sounds fucking disgusting.
That's horrible. Horrible. Oh,
drink it up.
Listeners, do not do this. Right. It's fucking gross.
Seeing that everybody's Irish, it was kind of a... Well, does he mean, like, have a heart? Is he kind of referring it to it as the idiom? Like, you know, have mercy.
Right.
It's got Swedish punch and gin, and maybe it's... I thought, like, maybe it's powerful? I don't know. Maybe it tastes strong? I don't know. You know, this wasn't really a pattern. But, you know, the fact that he has a lot of theater actors coming into his bar... Certainly possible that he named it after the play. I will say, almost definitively, it's not named after the movie. So, as we said, the book comes out in 1934, the same year that the movie comes out. And I thought, well, okay, you know, we were talking, well, maybe it was a last-minute entry, he really loved the movie. But there's a note in the preface that says that this book, most of the following extensive and carefully selected list of cocktails have been served over first-class bars in the United States, South America, Canada, and Europe since our Civil War. There are, however, a considerable number which have been created here during the period of Prohibition, 1917 to 1933, and some of these are obviously of irresponsible origin. So, to me, that says, if they're saying that it's selective, they're picking certain drinks, I don't think he's throwing in one at the last second. And then he also says, they say that, we consider ourselves extremely fortunate in having secured for this purpose the services of Patrick Gavin Duffy, one of the most colorful figures and celebrated bartenders of the Halcyon days. So that's the publisher's talking in the introduction. Now, to me, that says, if they're saying the Halcyon days, now he was from a particular time period. He was working in like the Ashland House from like until 1894, and then he opened up his own place in the 1890s. So I did a little more digging, trying to see, look at his book. You know, when did it actually come out? 1934? Because that, you know, if the movie came out after the book, then
yeah,
done.
Yeah.
And I found an article that from the New York Times, December 7th, 1933, and it says, as of December 5th, Long & Smith sent out yesterday copies of Patrick Gavin Duffy's The Official Mixer's Manual. So December 5th, 1933, prior to the movie being released. So
Okay. Definitively,
it is not named after the movie.
Okay.
That's cool. It's like he's hanging with those theater folks.
It seems likely. It could still be after the idiom. Maybe he was just like, quotation marks, you know. You know, have a heart.
I'm just astounded because, I mean...
You're astounded how many times I'm able to prove Ted Hager.
This is going to end in a Hague celebrity fight,
That is just so...
Big, oversized boxing gloves and a very tiny ring.
Big foam fingers.
I wasn't even setting out to prove him wrong. And I will say, a lot of times I am. I'm like, oh, this sounds like clear bullshit.
Yeah.
I wasn't even trying to prove him wrong. What I was trying to do was prove that it was not named after the movie and sort of... If anything, it might be named after the play. And so finding that article came after finding that he hung out with a lot of theater people, that he was in New York. It just happened that I thought of it after. I said, well, let's try to lay this to rest. Easy enough. I didn't even search that hard for it. I was like, oh, here we go. Here's Patrick Gavin Duffy's book being released. And even though, I mean, it's published in 1934, but it's sent out in 1933. It's done.
Yeah.
And the other part of it is that the way the publishers are talking about it is that they're bringing him in. So this is what I sort of want to get.
They're promoting it at that point. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, he's a person. He's a person of some fame. He's a famous bartender, at least. It's after Prohibition. So the way that we've always talked about him, I was always under the impression that he sort of weathered Prohibition, that he was a bartender up until the very last moment, and then he continued on doing other things.
Jerk.
Right, and then he, after Prohibition, he was like, back on this horse and let's publish a book. But I'm not sure that that was actually the truth the more I looked at it, because from what I can tell, it seems like he was bartending up through the 1890s, and I'm not sure he was bartending after that. I feel like he might have, you know, once it was getting close to even before Prohibition, that he had taken a
interesting
hiatus, or maybe he wasn't doing it anymore. I don't exactly know
how old was he?
Well, if he said, so he, by his own information, he worked at the Ashland House until 1894. I think the Ashland House opened up in 1887. So then he opened up his own cafe, he's hanging out with actors. You know, they say he was the most celebrated bartenders of the Halcyon days. And to me, that seems like 1890s, at least definitely pre-Prohibition. So he's at the Ashland House in the 1890s. The book comes out in 1934. Do that timeline. 1894 to 1934, that's 40 years.
That's some time, man.
And he had to have been, by 1934, 60 at the very least, 70s. More likely, he was probably an old man.
He was the name that they were using.
Exactly. So it made me think, and I mean, as much as we've been pushing this, and I'm not saying that the recipes aren't his or that he didn't actively contribute to this book, but it did start to go, I wonder if this is more like the Cafe Royal cocktail book where it's Prohibition's done. get as many recipes as we get. And who do we know in New York? Well, Patrick Gavin Duffy's still alive. Let's talk to that guy.
And we need a face to go with.
Somebody before it.
Right.
Because that's what a lot of promotion was back then, right? It was a face.
Yeah.
You needed a personality. You needed a...
Especially in this media, somebody you could look at and go, oh, this is the guy.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, he knows what he's talking about, so clearly I'll buy your book. And, you know, when you look through his book, and we've seen this with almost every cocktail that is post-prohibition, or like, it's if it shows up in PGD's book, he got it from Craddock or McElhenney or Robert Vermeer. It came before. And so I started thinking, oh, maybe this book was just designed like the Cafe Royale. Get as many as you can.
Yeah.
We don't even care.
Yeah.
So it is, let's say it's entirely plausible. He knew an actor. He knew the producer. He knew somebody that was associated with the play.
Yeah.
That's more likely. But, you know, definitely the movie's out. That is clearly
wrong. Well, and this drink doesn't appear anywhere else.
No, it appears
nobody else took it. Nobody else picked it up.
And it makes sense. And that almost makes it more plausible that it was named after the play. Because it was a short-run play the year before Prohibition kicked in. So if he was even hanging around with theater people...
That's perfect.
He could, you know...
It makes perfect filler when the publisher's like, no, we need 10 more drinks.
figure it out. I remember this asshole theater guy. Exactly. He was like, kept telling me to make a drink after a stupid play.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you just don't know, but let's say it's plausible.
Yeah.
There's no proof. He never bothered to give any history to any of his drinks. It was always recipe and...
This is what it is, yeah.
Okay. Well, that's interesting.
PGD.
So that's the have a heart story.
I didn't even think about it. But, like, I really wasn't trying to prove him wrong. I just inadvertently proved him wrong.
Well, the timeline, yeah.
It was like, maybe I'm just getting that good at it where I'm like, I'm not even trying anymore. I'm researching other shit and I inadvertently
prove the facts are the facts.
It's called facts. and dates and timelines. Right. And
you know, the kicker is you go online and you see this repeated over and over. It's named after this movie. And the fact that IMDb doesn't even have a plot synopsis means it was like, this movie was not popular. Turner Classic Movies makes more sense because they want to.
Yeah,
they're classic movies, but IMDb didn't even have. I was like, well, if it doesn't have a plot synopsis, how am I going to figure out what this movie is about? I had no idea. I was like, what else do you do IMDb doesn't have it?
Well, I feel like I want to, like, I was originally excited to watch a crazy rom-com.
It probably is a crazy rom-com.
I mean, I want to see what one of those is like, but.
Probably a lot of people going, it seems like darling. It
was probably remade into, like, what's the one where they meet in the tower? Like, what's
Rapunzel?
No. it's the Sleepless in Seattle thing.
But yeah.
They made the same movie. What was it? It was...
They made another movie that's just like that?
Yeah, but it was an old movie, and it's called...
You've Got Mail.
Yeah, it's even older than that.
They're all the same.
No, it's exactly like that. She got hit by a car, and she was a dance teacher.
They meet in the Empire State Building, right?
Sleepless in Seattle was based on, was that movie. And I'm drawing a complete blank on what that movie was called.
So what Mickey's saying is that he watches a lot of romantic comedies.
Yeah, well, rom-coms, but only from 50s.
Only from the
50s. Not 60s, not 70s.
Well, it seems like I'm going to have to... Find a...
You're driving me crazy now.
A Broadway play from 1917, actually. I wonder if they have that on YouTube. Yeah, I wonder if I'm even going to be able to find audio on that. We get to drink a Swedish punch cocktail in any case.
It's
so
probably pretty tasty, I would guess.
And it looks vaguely peach colored. Okay.
Which is a requirement.
Yeah. Okay, on to the Rixon.
Vaguely peach colored.
Have a heart cocktail. 1.5 ounces Ford's gin. 3/4 ounce Cronin Swedish punch. 3/4 ounce lime juice, 1/4 ounce grenadine.
So we've made it to the Brixton, where we're going to have a heart. I'm here with Mr. Eric Martin.
Good evening.
Eric, are you a Broadway fan?
Depends on the show. I'm a big fan of the recent hit Hamilton. I also like most of Sondheim. Andrew Lloyd Webber is a lovely human being, but I don't like anything he's written. And the Have a Heart musical I was not super excited by, but...
I don't think anyone was.
I was not offended by it either, so...
Have you ever been to Broadway?
Ironically, the only show I've seen on Broadway is Phantom of the Opera, which is Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Oh, yeah.
I went with a group and so did not have a choice in what we saw.
But what does Broadway look like? Is it wide?
Not particularly. It's filthy and full of tourists. And when I went, there were intestines in the street. So it's New York City and it's like the rest of it, really.
Intestines in the street?
I can't tell if they were human or pig.
I would imagine pig. Were there police around?
No, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything in a city.
Okay. So Michael has brought us over the a little bit of Swedish punch.
Spelled with an extra S.
Yes.
I'm going to try a sip.
Did you smell it before?
It smells like Sharpie.
Yeah, doesn't it?
It's a good Sharpie.
It smells like one of the more delicious Sharpie flavors.
It smells like a Sharpie that I would sniff in the afternoon when I'm feeling low.
At that point in work, the 3 p.m. hour.
That is really good.
Isn't it? And it's very surprising. You thought that you'd be like sipping some thinner or something, right?
Yeah, but it's very sweet at first, and then there's an aftertaste that's more complex. A bit like molasses. It's very, very good.
Any burn?
No.
No.
I feel like I could get blackout drunk on that pretty easily.
What is it? So we're using Cronan Swedish Punch. I'm old, so I have to take my glasses off to see small print.
It's crazy. It really is. It isn't actually age. It's just the drinking that's caused it.
It's 26% alcohol.
Well, that's not much, really.
It's not, no. I mean, and basically it's rum that hasn't gotten as alcoholic as it possibly could.
Never been able to knock on a rum. Even bad ones are fun to drink.
I know, I like rum. As Eric indicated already, we came together and listened to the Have a Heart that we discussed in the first part of the show to really kind of get a sense of what Patrick Gavin Duffy was naming his cocktail after, and well, it was rather lackluster, I think. Though I wouldn't actually know. Phantom of the Opera, Cats, anything on Broadway is just not going to excite me.
I think most people can tell if they're watching high art.
What? Really? No, I don't think so. Most people?
I think most people can tell if they're watching something that has something new or different or at least entertaining going on.
Would you call much of what's on Broadway high art? And our Have a Hearts have arrived.
Have a Hearts, right. Simple drink. Mostly gin, a little bit of lime juice, about an ounce of the... about 3/4 ounce of the punch, and then about 1/2 ounce of the grenadine. Gives it a lot of citrus, a lot of sweetness. Gin, real clean liquor to work with, I use the Ford's gin.
You use Ford's gin? Okay, great.
And then that Cronin punch, that Swedish punch, is nice. It's real nice. Yeah. So, real pretty elegant drink, actually. Nice sipper.
Excellent, thank you. Okay, the nose is very limey. It's because there's a lime wedge on it.
This may sound unappetizing, but it smells a bit like the dish soap that my mom used to use growing up.
She used a lime dish soap?
It was more of an artificial lemon scented dish soap. This does taste better than that dish soap did.
It says lemon scented, not lemon flavored.
Well, the ingestion was very intentional on my parents' part.
Is this a mouth washing out kind of thing?
Yeah.
People still do that?
My parents preferred the old-fashioned punishments.
Did you try it yet?
I'm about to.
That Swedish punch comes through. It makes it more than just a gimlet.
I'm going back and forth on this. I like it and then I don't like it. It's very bright flavor.
That's a great way to describe it. It is very bright. It's very bright and clean, and I think that cleanness is the citrus. But it's better than just citrus.
I think it's the notes from the gin. The complex sweetness from the Swedish punch.
Totally. And there's grenadine in there too, I guess.
Yeah, I think my negative feelings about this drink are definitely childhood associations to...
to cleanser. You'll have a lot of difficulty with old cocktails. Because the juiciest fruits were all lemon and lime.
I think the gin has added a piney note that reinforces that in my mind.
It finishes a little bitter. Like, it's sweet up front. There's like that sweet and citrus flavor up front, and then it kind of relaxes and finishes bitter.
Just a little, though.
Yeah, it's not overpowering at all.
I think it's worth trying.
I think so, too. I don't know if I would drink these all night, but I think that it's a fun flavor to try.
And I would say the same thing about the musical.
So I've never been to Broadway. Have no idea what it looks like. I've never been to New York. Did you go on a school trip or something?
I've been a few times. I've only been to Broadway once. I mean, I've been on Broadway, but I haven't gone to a theater on Broadway, except for the one Andrew Lloyd Webber mishap. New York is nice to visit. I don't prefer it to Chicago. I've only ever gone in the summer, though, so maybe that's why. It's always really hot and the garbage is out on the streets, rotting for everyone to smell.
But did you go to all the places where tourists go? So it's all like, it's all the really highly visible things. You didn't see the quaint little restaurant, the dark corners that are interesting and cozy.
Yeah, I think my experiences were limited to some of the touristy spots. My last visit, I did try to get off of the main path, but it's hard when you're with other people who haven't been there before.
Totally.
They want to see all the big spots. And
especially if you're with people who aren't necessarily familiar with an urban environment.
I was with my teenage sister, so couldn't go out to drink anything, and we were limited to few restaurant options. So next time I go, hopefully it'll be with an adult, and hopefully we will be able to get off the path. And
well, there's also like inviting your friends from the suburbs to the city, and you're like, oh, come on down. There's a great restaurant. You know, I want to show you this place. It's awesome. These are people you know from work, and half of everybody who works in Chicago commutes from the suburbs. So, like, and then on occasion, you know, you're like, oh, let's go out to dinner. I know this great place. And then they come down and they find a place to park. It's really difficult because there's never any parking in Chicago. Anybody who lives in Chicago has managed it already. They've already dealt with it. They understand. We've got strategies. But people from the outskirts come and it's terrible. And then there's trash on the streets. And that means it's a terrible neighborhood. And then they pretend that they like, that they're comfortable with everything. And that they like coming to the city. When really they mean they like going to Magnificent Mile. Going to Michigan Avenue down in Chicago, where all of the shopping is. And they struggle through dinner. Maybe it's kind of a strange fusion. They're not used to anything that's not American bar food or, you know, TGI Fridays, Applebee's.
I mean, in their defense, I struggle just as much when I'm in the suburbs. So I walk down the street and there's no trash. I don't know what to do with myself. I'm lucky if there's a sidewalk.
That is true. You go out to the suburbs and it's clear. If you don't own a car, you shouldn't be here.
The restaurants there are difficult to navigate. Either you go to a chain or you take your chances on a small independent restaurant that has no competition and thus can serve whatever weird slop they want to. Coffee shops are even trickier to navigate, so suburbs and small towns, they're hard too, just in a different way. I think going anywhere that's different from where you live is difficult.
Okay, you're small town though. You know all about that. You just described it to a T. So you've managed that.
I've survived it.
Yeah, managing, surviving. Tomato, tomato. And I've done the same thing in suburbs. Phoenix, where I grew up, gigantic suburb. No interesting food. It's all chain restaurants. You never have to learn to parallel park. The whole city is built on a grid. It's made so that you can park anywhere the fuck you want. So when my parents come and visit, it's always a challenge with their driving in Chicago. I mean, Chicago was built for carts, horses and wagons. The streets are all crazy and stuff. Out west, all the cities are built for cars. So I'm familiar with the whole suburban thing. I feel like I can manage that okay.
I like seeing the suburbs while I'm in a rental car going to my hometown for the weekend. I have a hard time going to the suburbs. I just don't see any reason to go. Not for shopping, not for IKEA.
Have you been to an IKEA?
I've been to the IKEA in that horrible little suburb northwest.
That one?
Schaumburg, I think.
Okay. I've never been to an IKEA, so I don't know what I'm missing.
It's an experience. I think that you should go just to see what it's about, and unless you really need cheap furniture, never go again.
I hear it's got kind of a carnival atmosphere.
That's because there's a bunch of ugly people trying to sell you things.
I thought that was Walmart.
That's also Walmart.
But IKEA, they're Swedish.
Well, the employees in the U.S. are not Swedish.
They didn't import the employees?
They should. I think it would be a good marketing strategy. But I don't know anyone from Sweden that would want to move to the U.S.
That's a fair point.
Your taxes are lower, but you get nothing.
Yeah, you get nothing for them.
You get the road that you drive on to work at IKEA. Sometimes. Sometimes you get that road. Most of the time it's under construction.
That's interesting, though. I feel fine in the suburbs. I just recently got a new job way out in the suburbs. And there's, like, everything out there. Before I go home, I can stop off and get whatever I need. Whatever that might be, there's a store for it. I don't have to parallel park. It's just a very easy, nice little life. But it is all... Everything is very much the same. It's very homogenous.
It's built to lower stress in a certain type of person. It's not built for interesting experiences. I mean,
that's what we need. We need more interesting experiences.
There are some small towns that break that.
Are those the ones with the giant ball of string?
Yeah, or Silver Dollar City in Missouri. I don't know what town that's in, but they try really, really hard to be different.
Why? What are they doing?
Well, they have a theme park and a bunch of country singers, and you can't get that in Schaumburg. Oh, wait, no, I think there is a theme park and country singers in IKEA. I take that back. There's also Swedish meatballs there.
So is this place by Branson?
That sounds about right. I think Branson...
Branson, Missouri!
Yes, the family-friendly vacation spot.
It's like Nashville, like a chunk of Nashville got cut loose and sent west?
If you took Nashville and sucked out all the creativity, good food, and charm, you'd have Branson.
Do you know Nashville?
I have spent some time in Nashville. I know many great people in Nashville. There is an interesting folk music movement going on there, which is a reaction to the pop country.
Awesome. I hadn't heard that.
You can find these singers on, like, NPR music channels and out in the internet trying to make a living. There's also Nashville Hot Chicken, which, if you haven't had it, is both amazing and will make you hate yourself. There's a really big soul food vibe there that you wouldn't expect for someplace so far north. It's an interesting city. It's not a city I would live in, but it's an interesting city.
Yeah, I feel like Tennessee and Kentucky are both kind of misplaced, kind of orphans.
Politically, I think you're correct. Like, politically, they seem very deep south, but their cultures are, in my experience, are different than the deep south. They have something unique going on. Appalachian or Appalachian, however you say it.
That makes you a little bit rougher in a mountainous region. You just really have nothing except for whiskey and fur.
Yeah, they had the whole bootlegging thing that they had going on.
And neither of those things is very stable.
Part of me is really drawn to that region. It makes me want to play guitar and just hide out in the mountains. It sounds all very romantic to me.
That Martin feud?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if there were a clan of Martins hiding in the mountains that had a feud with another.
Fighting with the McCorkles?
The McCorkles. McCorkles or the McGonagalls. I wouldn't be surprised. I want to go visit my distant cousins. Drink some moonshine. Have some hot chicken. And, I mean, they know how to party.
That they do. It's funny, they probably party kind of like a lot of the urban dwellers do as well.
Where they get super drunk and stumble home because they missed the last bus.
Where they get super drunk and then everybody has to manage their firearms.
Oh, that kind of city.
I'm enjoying the cocktail. I think it's a good cocktail. Could be less citrusy, but I would say that of any citrusy cocktail.
I think it needs more citrus, actually.
Oh my god.
Some Buddha's hand would be nice.
Yeah, you go straight to the strange shit.
Some kumquat.
We've had our part. We figured out what it is that Patrick Evan Duffy was talking about. This cocktail, is it a third-rate Broadway show?
I don't know.
I think we should come up with a new narrative for this. I mean, other people make up history, why can't we? I would love to see three other cocktails. Have a brain, have some courage, and have a home. And then we could just say it was all based on The Wizard of Oz.
That's right. And that is far more fun.
I would love to drink the Are You a Good Witch or a Bad Witch cocktail.
We'll work on it. Until next time, Black Livers. Goodbye now.
Shooting straight for the... I know that it hurts, but it has to be said that it's finally over, and it tears me apart. Shooting straight for the heart. This is talking past tense is the first sign of doom. No use in trying, it is what it is. No use in denying this mercy.
Hey everybody, thanks for listening to the Monster in a Glass podcast. I'd like to thank Jason Cruz for researching our content, our regular tasting team, Rachel Rubin, Kevin Ratajczak, Bethany Lang, and Nicole Pizzini, for joining me in the grueling task of tasting the cocktails we discuss. The Brixton and their bartender, Michael Donnelly, for letting us cavort in their liquid playground, Dan Cruz for art direction and editing, and Mark Piani for the music at the head of the show. Go to blacklittleproject.com to see the show archive, become a member, contribute to the project, and get in touch with us. And follow us on Facebook and Twitter to get the latest news and as it happens updates during live events. And as always, if you're into thinking and drinking, let us blacken your liver.
No use in denying. I know.